From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nambi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with at-large Montgomery County Council member Hans Riemer. But joining us now is Charles Allen. He's a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 6. Charles Allen, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good afternoon, everybody.
Allow me to tell you all what Tom Sherwood has accomplished. In the fixes in the Washington Post report of outstanding politics reporters to follow in every state, there is our own Martin Ostermule of WAMU, and, of course, Tom Sherwood, also listed as WAMU. When Tom Sherwood left NBC4 and we thought he was retiring, he said he's not retiring. He is refocusing. Well, he obviously is refocused with a vengeance here because he's still a top reporter. Tom Sherwood, congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. So that's a nice list of reporters, particularly Martin Ostermule, who does so much work for WAMU and D.C. Local journalism is under a threat because of the nature of funding local reporters and media in general. Lots of traditional reporters have lost their jobs. There's a lot more social media reporting going on where people have to go for information, but it's very nice to be mentioned.
Well, these reporters are supposed to be the nemesis of politicians everywhere. Do you find that to be the case, Councilmember Allen? Nemesis of politicians everywhere.
I think local journalism is critical if you expect accountability and good government. And I think we've got just the absolute best here in D.C. focus on the local level. It's critically important. If you want government to work, you need local journalism.
But Tom Sherwood and yours truly are not without opinions. In the final episode of the podcast, 51st, which airs from WAMU, we were both featured in that podcast because we have passionate feelings about statehood for the District of Columbia. And Tom told a great story. And I like to say that when you're a reporter, you leave your opinions at the door, but you don't leave your humanity, you don't leave your human rights, and you don't leave your civil rights at the door. And so Michaela LaFrac was apparently happy to report that Tom and I have strong feelings about statehood. And then she talked about what it is like being a reporter who lives in a city that does not have voting rights and statehood and how she feels about that herself. Care to comment, Tom?
Well, I tell journalism students, professors like to say a journalist has to be objective. And I say that the only objective person is a dead person. What you have to do is try to be as fair, find out as much as you can, report as best as you can, and be fair. And that's what I feel about statehood. I think that as a citizen of the city, I deserve the opportunity and rights of all United States citizens, and I'm for statehood. As a reporter, and D.C. Vote will tell you this, I've been quite critical about the episodic way the city has gone about trying to get statehood.
Well, and that is obviously true. Next week on this broadcast, we'll be talking about the podcast 51st with Michaela LaFrac, and so we'll also be talking statehood then. But Charles Allen getting on to what's going on now. Yesterday, the Metropolitan Police Department released body-worn camera footage from a D.C. police officer in the cruiser that pursued Caron Hilton. The video shows the police car following Hilton, who can be seen riding a moped with no helmet. During the pursuit, Hilton crashed into a passenger vehicle. He died on Monday. What was your response to the footage? Before you respond, allow me to invite our listeners to also call. Charles Allen, would you respond?
Yeah, first and foremost, of course, our thoughts are with Caron Hilton's family, young daughter. And, I've spoken with his family a couple of times this week, and they're in grief, and trying to put the pieces together here. But as a council member and as the chair of this committee, as I watch the video that's been released thus far, and I've made the request for the full unredacted video, which I'll be able to see later as well, there's a lot of questions and concerns that come up. I mean, first and foremost is, why were four officers giving chase to someone on a moped, supposedly simply because they didn't have a helmet on? I can tell you, there's no way that we're going to be able to separate, I think, race from what we saw. I feel pretty damn sure if I didn't have a helmet on riding my bike or a moped, I'm not going to be chased through an alley by an MPD cruiser with four officers in there. Secondly, I think I'm very concerned about the way in which our body-worn camera was activated. And so the officers click it on essentially after Mr. Hilton has the collision with the vehicle. And because we have essentially video that gets buffered and captured along the way, we have some video, but we have no audio. We don't know if the other two officers turned their BWC on. There's a lot more, and there's a lot more questions that now come up. And then I got to say, watching the video, hearing the officers when they first get out, and they don't appear to run, they appear to walk, call out. They clearly knew Mr. Hilton because they called him out by his first name, but we have somebody lying unconscious and injured on the street, and it doesn't feel like there's a sense of urgency. And I think it makes me certainly question why, and you know, why wouldn't we see that urgency? Because in what ways do we see this as a part of the entire nature of policing and structural racism that we're talking about, not just in DC, but around the entire country? I think the video, it's important to release the video, but I think it also raises many more questions that deserve answers, not just for Mr. Hilton's family, but for the whole city.
Did you get any answers? Because Police Chief Peter Newsham has said that officers are not allowed to pursue vehicles for traffic violations if they refuse to stop. Did you get any answers about why all these four police officers were pursuing a moped?
I think we've heard pretty clear. MPD has put out their statement that this was a pursuit because they were following someone who wasn't wearing their helmet. That is not consistent with our policies. We have a don't chase policy for a reason. And I think you see exactly how this plays out. We've seen security video, which also shows private security video that shows the chase going on in an alley. So we still have questions around exactly what prompted the initial start of the interaction. But I don't think there's any question from watching this that there was a pursuit. I do not believe it's consistent and followed our MPD policies. And at the end of the day, we also have to ask the question, what were folks hoping to gain with this? Why would we pursue and chase somebody over a helmet, purportedly? In what ways did it make our city and our neighborhood safer? In what ways was it achieving safety and justice to chase somebody through alleys? That's a question that we need to really be working on and struggling with around what is the role of policing, and in what ways are we doing this in a way that keeps our city safe and do so in a just way?
Tom Sherwood.
Council member, thanks for being here today. Do we know the race of the four officers involved?
I do not know the race of the two officers in the back, and I don't believe the race information was released yesterday on the officers in the front.
Okay. You issued a very strong statement in which you say you did speak to the family, and you said you still need much more information, but mm-hmm. I want to quote you in your statement. You say, "What we do know is that he should be alive today, and that how Mr. Hilton was treated and why he was killed cannot be disconnected from his race," and that you later say, "I find it hard to believe the officers would have acted with a similar lack of empathy with a white resident." Would you comment on that? And also earlier this week, Chief Newsham at a press conference also strongly indicated that this might have been an improper chase, but he couldn't say it because it's under investigation. But how much does race play a factor in this?
Well, I think that for most people, I don't think very many people actually believe that this chase was about somebody not wearing a helmet. I just don't think that's a plausible argument. I think that within our own lived experiences, again, as a white guy, if I was riding down the street or on the sidewalk on my bike without a helmet on, I don't think there's a single scenario where I'm ever going to have a cruiser with four officers give chase to me. And there's a large amount of that has to do with the color of my skin. I think that when we talk about the nature of policing and when we talk about the over-policing that we often see in our black and brown communities, this is where this comes from. Mr. Hilton should be alive today. He should be able, I mean, his daughter should grow up with a father. This is wrong. And I think there's absolutely a concern here.
Right. Whatever the race of the officers, the misconduct is the issue, not necessarily the race of the four officers. But let me ask you about the Twitter war that erupted, I think, this morning or last night. You've tweeted about the family suffering this loss. The D.C. Police Union has also entered the Twitter war, telling us that in a quick tweet they say that a reminder that 12 officers were hospitalized last night. It's a reference to the violence at some of the demonstrations at the 4D headquarters. And they say that some had career-ending injuries. And they say that Charles Allen, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, has yet to show one iota of condolence or concern for the police officers. How is it different from being concerned about Mr. Hilton's family and the police officers in these violent protest situations?
Yeah, you know, I've worked actually with FOP leadership in the past. You know, they've supported body cameras, for example. I've worked on legislation with them to ensure that officers that are seriously injured on the job are able to keep working. And the FOP is right in one regard in their statement. That is that everyone deserves to be free from violence, and that includes officers. But importantly, I'd like to add that that also included Quran. I think the current leadership just has its head in the sand, and they're pretending that policing somehow doesn't need to change. I don't think that's reflective of the many men and women in the department, actually, who are frustrated with the status quo. I know, as a council member, I talk with officers.
Only got about a minute left in this segment.
Sure, but they want to tackle these difficult issues. They're tired of being asked to do everything for everybody, and they want to be able to have the support to have the right type of response to get the right type of help to the person in need.
Maybe you'll have to answer this after the break, but the law requires this video, police video, to be released, but it apparently only requires the immediate action video to be released and not all of it. Will we get to see all the video of all the officers? Or will we have to change the law to make that happen?
Indeed, the council member is going to have to respond to that after the break, because the break is right now. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with D.C. Council Member Charles Allen. I'm Kojo Nandi. Welcome back to our conversation with Councilmember Charles Allen. He's a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 6. We're taking your calls. Councilmember Allen, when we took that break, you were about to respond to a question from Tom Sherwood.
Yes. Yeah, thanks.
Sure. Is the law tough enough? The law requires police video to be released, but is it broad enough that all the video be released?
Yeah, so the law currently has that responding officer's body-worn camera, and we're actually considering permanent legislation right now to try to examine how far that should go. Should it be every officer on the scene, every responding officer? There's also the question around how much should be redacted. Right now, currently, officers aren't shown. They're serving in their official function. They're in uniform, serving the public. Should their faces be redacted? There's a lot of questions that we're working through right now on permanent legislation to be able to handle and, I think, address the question that you've got.
Here now is Marty in Bethesda. Marty, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk on the show and certainly hear the comments of the council people. I got to tell you something. Before I knew anything about this person, I knew the story. I knew he was African-American. Nobody told me that. I didn't have to wait to hear it. The police officers turned on their lights and ordered him to stop. That's a lawful order. He chose to disobey that. I've been stopped by cops, and I pull over. I don't fight them. They tell me that I follow the lawful orders of the police. I do what I, you know, you live in a society of law. And if you disobey the law, there's consequences. He also chose to ride a moped without wearing a helmet. That's against the law. So there's two violations that he committed. He chose to make these decisions, and ultimately it led to his death. It's unfortunate. But the problem is, are we living in a society? I mean, D.C. wants statehood, or many residents of D.C. want statehood, but what they don't want to do is extract or demand accountability of the people that live in the city.
No, I think making that relationship between D.C. wanting statehood and requiring accountability from its residents is a false comparison. I think what we are looking for in this situation is accountability from the police officers, because police officers, according to the police chief, are not allowed to pursue people who seem to be getting away from them. But I'd prefer to have Councilmember Allen respond.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think it's a pretty ridiculous argument to try to loop statehood into something like that. We have a very clear policy around a chase. And trying to follow the caller's logic, are we saying that if I don't put a helmet on, then that equals the death sentence? I mean, that just doesn't make any sense. Especially trying to loop this into statehood in some way. We have clear policies and guidelines about what this is and what has to be followed. I mean, a comment like that, that if you want to ask what systemic racism looks like, that's what you just heard from your caller. That's just a ridiculous statement.
Well, one more thing we do have to talk about, and Jennifer in Virginia wants to address that. Jennifer, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, council member, first of all, for ridiculousness, you cannot say the statement that not wearing a helmet is a death sentence. This death, unfortunate death, sad death, happens because of a traffic accident, because the victim pulled out in front of another innocent victim and was hit by a car, not because of the pursuit. And the pursuit, everybody, is not a high-speed pursuit, a moped at max 20 miles per hour. How fast is this case really happening? It's not. The rules in D.C. and the laws for high-speed pursuit are to protect innocent victims that are walking around, innocent citizens, so that there's no aftermath.
Okay, we don't have a lot of time, but I thought you wanted to talk about the violence that took place in the protests.
The media is missing on the responsibility of reporting both, because hyping it, sensationalizing it in one avenue has brought down the aftermath of all the people reacting emotionally, just as the other side shift. That half is
well,
now.
Like I said, we don't have a great deal of time for lectures, Jennifer, but Councilmember Charles Allen, what do you say to people who say, how about the violence on the part of some of the protesters who injured police officers and attacked the 4th District?
Yeah, well, as I've said before, I support the right for all Americans to be able to peacefully protest, and violence against anyone, police officer or civilian, is unacceptable. I want the officers that have been injured to have a safe and healthy recovery along with the protesters. But to turn the death of Karan into a conversation around that is a bit of a distraction. We need to remember what this is about, and about the changes that we're trying to make within policing. And this is not easy work. This is hard. But we also have to think about what is the power differential that you see within protest. There are significant challenges that we have to be tackling, and we also have to stay focused on trying to make sure that we have a safe and just city. That we are working toward that. That violence against anyone is unacceptable. And that's where I start from. And then we have to do the hard work of making sure that we're building that out within our systems, within our policing, within all of our public safety apparatus that goes beyond just law enforcement, to work on gun violence in our city, to work on all violence, to make it so this is, you know, we live in a great city, and we want this to be a safe and just place for everyone.
Tom Sherwood.
I appreciate that you want more information. I think the whole city wants more information about what happened here, and I hope we all get it, and I hope you get it. But let me ask you also about going into this election weekend. The police department is concerned about violence in the protests that may occur during the elections. Or have you been briefed? People are downtown, are like once again boarding up some of their stores. Have you been briefed by police on what they expect in the coming days, and are you confident that we're ready?
I have been briefed. We have our police department, our emergency management, Homeland Security departments have been working collaboratively, not just in D.C., but within the region to prepare for this. We even go through, kind of your worst case scenarios to try to help think through how we would respond and what those plans are. I think that, like a lot of people, folks are concerned about what this current occupant of the White House is going to do and what lengths he may go through. I mean, we saw what they did this summer, activating National Guard, intimidating, threatening, harming protesters, peaceful protest. The federalization that we are going to potentially see is very concerning. And I think probably if we'd at the beginning of the summer, if we thought that's what we would see come out of the White House and see those forces turned against peaceful protest, maybe not everybody would have thought that would have happened, but it did. And so we have to prepare for many contingencies, but there's a lot of really hard work and thought that's going into that to be prepared as the nation's capital to be ready for this.
If there are D.C. voters who still need to vote, how should they do it?
Thanks. We're closing in. We're, I think, 5 days away. And I want to say to D.C. voters, I think you guys have done a fantastic job. We're already over 70% of the total ballots cast from 4 years ago have been cast early. And there's three main ways that that's taking place. First is by mail. Second is by Dropbox, which over 100,000 people have used. And then also our early voting centers. I would say at this point, I would encourage people to make their plan to vote either with a Dropbox or the in-person early voting. With the post office, we're starting to see those delays pile up. In D.C., our law is that as long as it's postmarked by the 3rd, the Board of Elections has 10 days to receive it. But I think we're nearing the time frame and we're seeing the delays stack up. My recommendation to all voters, if you haven't voted already, would be either use one of the Dropboxes. There's about 50 all over the city. You can find them on the Board of Elections website, or use our early vote centers, and that's the best way to cast your ballot. I still think, even with the great early vote turnout, if you wait until Tuesday to vote, you should still expect a line, but I think we're doing a great job with early voting. I'm really proud of the way folks have embraced the new ways to vote safe and vote early and get those ballots in so that those ballots and your vote, your voice and your vote will be counted.
Here is on the phone LaRubi May in Washington, D.C. I assume this is the former council member for Ward 8, and am I correct?
Yes, sir.
Well, go ahead, please. We only have about a minute left in this segment. We're going to ask Charles Allen to stick around for a little while longer, but you might be able to get your question in. Go ahead.
Yes. First, I want to extend my condolences to the Hilton family. And what we know as a personal injury lawyer is that the Hilton family likely will bring litigation in this case, and then Mr. Hilton's daughter will be faced with the reality of the discrimination that will happen in this civil litigation. And so I appreciate Councilmember Allen's aggressive posture in this place, but want to know why, ask him why he's not been as aggressive in moving forward and marking up the Stormaya Denson Action Act, which will remove the discrimination that will likely happen against
okay.
the estate of Mr. Hilton.
I'll have Charles Allen answer that after we take this short break. I'm Coach Onamde. Welcome back. We'll be talking shortly with Montgomery County Councilmember Hans Riemer. We're still talking with D.C. Councilmember who represents Ward 6, Charles Allen. And Charles Allen, when we went to that break, you were getting a question from your former colleague on the council, LaRubi May. Care to respond?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that from Councilmember May. The bill she's referring to was just introduced, I think it was in early August. We held a hearing on it already. In October, and we're moving it forward in the next couple of months. So it's from a legislative standpoint, it's actually moving pretty quickly. But it's an important issue that I know that she is advocating for and others as well, that I think it really gets to some of the, frankly, the structural racism that we see within civil litigation and civil awards. And so I think it's a really important issue, and I'm proud of the fact that we're moving this forward.
Tom Sherwood.
Mr. Councilmember, one last quick question. Last Friday, you were very critical, along with other council members, of schools chancellor Louis Farabee's plan to reopen some schools on November the 9th. It sounded like to me and other people that the schools should not do this on November 9th, but stay with remote learning. Do you have any more stronger feeling about that? Should the schools delay this November 9th reopening?
You know, I've got two little kids of my own. I'm dealing with virtual learning every day. And there is nothing I would rather have than to have them safely back in their classroom. And I've talked with hundreds of teachers that feel the same way, that there's nothing they would like more than to be able to see their students and see their kids safely in their classroom. But the key word there is safely. I remain very concerned about the plan to do so safely. But I'm also very concerned about the issues of equity. The current plan is treating every single school, whether you are in Ward 3 or Ward 8, the exact same way. And I don't think that's going to be reflective of what our students' needs are and how we can best serve our students that are going to be struggling with learning loss and many other challenges in this virtual setting. So I continue to be very concerned. I'm sorry?
You think it would be better to delay the November 9th opening?
Yeah, I don't see how it's going to be ready by then, and I think that it would benefit from having more time to get this right. And I think especially as we see infections around the country continue to increase, I question whether or not we're going to be able to do this safely. So any parent I talk to, I know they would love to have their kids back in a classroom, but it's got to be done safely because we care about our students, we care about our teachers, and we want to make sure this gets done right.
Charles Allen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, everybody.
Joining us now is Hans Riemer. He is an at-large member of the Montgomery County Council. Councilmember Hans Riemer, thank you for joining us.
It's great to be back, Kojo. Thank you so much.
Tom Sherwood, can we talk briefly about this race in Virginia, in the 5th District that is no longer considered the most competitive race in the country, but it is still one of the most competitive races in the country between Republican contender Bob Good and Democratic challenger Cameron Webb?
Yes, very quickly. The 5th District pretty much runs through the center of the state, and it's been largely Republican. But in a state that's increasingly turning blue, the Republicans in the 5th District thought that their incumbent Republican Congress member, Denver Riggleman, was not conservative enough. So this summer they threw him out and nominated Bob Good, who's very, very conservative. And now the Democrat, Dr. Cameron Webb, is seen as having at least a 50-50 chance of maybe taking that seat back for the Democrats. It's a sign of how the Republican Party may not be listening to the changing demographics of the state of the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Hans Riemer, last week, Montgomery County Executive Mark Eldridge vetoed the first bill of his career, a bill that you co-sponsored, which would offer incentives to developers who want to build high-rise buildings above metro stations. This week, the county council voted to override the veto. Why is this bill important to you, and where do you and the county executive not see eye to eye?
Thank you so much. The issue is that Metro does not have the funds to support development on their stations, and developing on Metro stations is extremely expensive due to replacing parking, reinforcing tunnels, modifying entrances, and Metro has to spend its money on trains and buses and the system. So as a local jurisdiction, we really want the benefits of high-rise development on our Metro stations to bring new housing, to support our climate objectives, to support our transportation objectives, to support our economic development objectives. But if we aren't willing to partner with the private sector to make that happen, what you see now is what you're going to get for decades. And we, the county council, felt very strongly that it was time for a change, that having barren concrete, you know, metro station areas is just completely anathema for our smart growth vision.
Well, both the county executive and a couple of your colleagues on the council say this would not create a significant amount of affordable housing. What say you?
Well, at full build out, the county stations in the county could, metro stations in the county could fit 8,500 or so housing units, including 12 or 1,300 housing units devoted to our county's own affordable housing programs, many of which are made available to low-income, very low-income residents. So 8,500 market units, first of all, is just a good thing. Like, we need more housing. We have a big housing shortage in the county, and we're just not going to get it in these locations unless we make a change. So, you know, I know the county executive has had a long time hostility to market rate housing, and we've had a lot of battles over that. But I think the county council felt strongly that we've got to make a change, that having parking garages and parking lots on top of our metro stations is just not going to generate any revenue, not going to support economic development, not going to support climate or housing, any of those very broad-based goals.
Tom Sherwood.
I think one of the criticism is that there's a tax abatement of 15 years for the developers. But you clearly are not a fan of Mark Elrich's. Let me get right to the politics of the council. You are term limited on the council as of 2022. Are you going to run for county executive in 2022? Or would you support someone like David Blair, who lost to Elrich by only 77 votes in the primary of 2018? Where are you in your politics since you're term limited and out of office 2 years from now?
Well, you know, with COVID, I've been focused on getting the job done at the county council. But
well,
stepping back,
that, are you going to have you? What are you going to do? Are you going to look at running?
Well, I was going to say, stepping back, I think the county has a bright future. But I think in order to make that possible, we've got to make a lot of changes, and we have to embrace changes. It takes leadership to do that. I think it's no secret that I think we could do a lot better than the county executive Elrich.
So that's
I think he
yes.
is out of touch. So I'm certainly looking
yes.
at it, but you know, right now I'm focused on working with my colleagues on COVID response.
Okay. Got
at the
it.
County council.
Here's we have lots of questions for you. Here's another one, which is immediate work of the council. After an ethics issue, county chief administrator Andrew Klein had to resign, and Mark Elrich nominated in the council in September, confirmed Rich Madalino as the new county administrator. He has at least quieted some of the criticisms about Mark Elrich. How is Rich Madalino doing in terms of dealing with the council since you're so disappointed with Mark Elrich?
Well, I think Rich has been helpful. I think council members know him, and I think there's a lot of respect for Rich. So I think he is constructive in relationships with the council. I think at the same time, the public policy issues are really what's driving the divide between the two branches. And Rich isn't bringing a different public policy to the table than Mark Elrich. So I think you might hopefully see perhaps a little less personal friction over time, but the clash is really a clash over ideas and direction of the county, and I don't see that changing.
Here is Sam in Gaithersburg, Maryland. Sam, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello. I was just calling to comment on the topic that you just discussed about possible high rises and private development above Metro Station. To the council member, I do understand, you know, the funds for a lot of these developments will bring in does help with metro repairs and upgrades and things like that. But if you could comment, what kind of developments will these be? Will it be mainly for the population around those stations, like, for example, around your Silver Spring stations where it's more middle to somewhat lower class residents, or are these being considered more so for like luxury high rises and like luxury office buildings and things that really don't, you know, cater to the population around some of these parts here? Because a lot
question.
Of times
okay.
when you look into private developers coming in and doing things like these, they're not doing it for people that, you know, are really not.
They're doing it for higher income people. What do you say, Hans Riemer?
Well, first of all, it's the private sector that will be doing the development, and every market is different. You know, the rents commanded at a station in Bethesda are going to be different from Shady Grove or Wheaton. So it will always be context sensitive. We are seeking high-rise development with this incentive. It's not open to low and mid-rise development. And it will be market, you know, it'll be market rate housing, which, you know, the reason why housing is so expensive in the county, a lot of it has to do with a long-term slowdown of the market. We're not producing housing that drives up the prices for everybody. So what we're trying to do is bring a shot in the arm to the housing market, bring more housing at the market level, but also at the affordable level. More than 1,000 units in our set-aside affordable programs for low-income people. That's a win-win.
You were the only member of the council who voted to suspend late-night alcohol sales, which allows some restaurants and bars to serve alcohol between 10 p.m. and midnight. Why did you want to shut this program down?
Well, I didn't want to allow it to open. this was a reopening that the executive branch proposed, the council voted on a couple weeks ago. I think it's a bad idea to allow late-night drinking. Keep in mind, this is indoor. It's socializing without masks, generally speaking. And, you know, I think the facts have borne out my vote. I was the only vote against it. Within days, the daily case count in the county exceeded the allowed limit in the regulation. And we are now, unfortunately, on an escalator upwards in our daily case count. And I think this is going to be one of the very first. It should have already been suspended, but it's going to be one of the first things that gets lifted.
Colin in Silver Spring, Maryland. Colin, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Councilmember Reamer. So this is Colin, head of the Montgomery County Backyard Chicken Keepers Coalition. So I'm curious to hear from you if we're able to continue moving forward on changing the rule on what is allowed for folks to raise chickens in their backyard. Currently, it's a 100-foot setback. This is an equity issue. Obviously, there's many more important issues to be talked about with COVID and all that's going on. But this is an easy way for low-income families to provide a daily source of protein in their backyard for their children. And so I'm wondering how we can move forward on this, and if you have any timeline suggestions for how this can go through in your committee. Thanks.
Thank you for that question. Believe it or not, most of Montgomery County is really off limits to backyard chicken coops because you have to have 100-foot distance to your neighbor's house. And that was a battle we fought six, seven years ago. I lost the vote on that one. I do think we need to change that rule. Our bandwidth is pretty strained right now with the COVID environment, and it's hard to get to every priority. But I strongly believe we need a change here. I think anybody who knows someone with backyard chickens, I think it's very questionable as to whether that is allowed. And yet it is typically a harmonious, you know, experience for the owner and for the neighbors. So, you know, we got to tackle that one. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your call. I wanted to get to school openings. Montgomery County residents have been protesting the county public school system keeping in-person learning closed. Other jurisdictions are bringing some students back. Montgomery County public schools will be closed at least through the first semester. When and how do you think the schools should reopen?
Thank you. This is probably one of the more challenging questions we're facing at this time. You know, right now what's happening is cases are rising, and nobody knows how long that's going to continue. What might have seemed safe 2 weeks ago seems a lot less safe today. And I think 2 weeks from now, we could be in a very different situation. So I think there was wisdom in the school's decision to go virtual while we weren't sure what a fall wave would look like. And, you know, again, 2 weeks ago, we had 75 cases average a day. We're up to nearly 125 today. Where are we going to be in a month? What if we're at 200 or 300 a day? You know, we don't know. So there is a way to reopen safely. I think we know what that is, but it also is much safer in the context of lower community transmission of the disease. And, you know, right now it's hard to be optimistic that in 2 or 3 weeks or a month, we're going to be in any kind of place that is safe. And what I think is really damaging is when the school systems have to go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. What we have right now is executing as best we can on virtual learning. We're trying to open up community hubs for in-person learning for disadvantaged kids as much as we can. And if we can get this virus more under control, I think we can really look at reopening. But the transmission numbers are very concerning right now.
Well, here's what George in Maryland has to say about that. George, your turn. George in Germantown.
Thank you. I wanted to ask Mr. Reamer, some school worker union representatives were immediately invited to the table for the planning on getting the kids back to school. And I'd like to ask him if he has any insight on why representatives from McGeo, the union representing the school nurses, were not initially invited to the planning on this reopening of the schools. They're there now after McGeo's action, but that omission seems preposterous, how the school nurses were not there from the outset and had to take action on their own to get there. How could the county have let that happen?
Hans Reamer.
Interesting question. Frankly, that information has not been shared with the county council. I'm inferring that the McGeo is at the table at this time. The nurses are an absolutely essential part of a reopening strategy. So I hope that that is back on track, and I'll follow up on that.
Tom Sherwood.
Thank you. County Executive Elrich and every member of the council has expressed concerns about a wave of tenant evictions expected once the public health crisis is over. Can you summarize what the status of the county is in terms of helping to avoid hundreds, if not thousands, of evictions by large and small landlords?
Yeah. Well, first of all, we are...
Summarize.
Yeah, summarize. We're providing a lot of rental assistance, first of all. We're helping tenants get out of arrears. And we're going to continue to help tenants get out of arrears. Secondly, we're educating tenants about their rights. Tenants have rights in court. You know, whether it's federal eviction or state eviction legal frameworks, tenants have rights in court. So that's really where we are focusing, is getting help to tenants so that they are not in arrears,
legal
and
help.
Educating them so that they can defend themselves in court.
Legal help.
Legal help, absolutely. We are providing legal help. We are providing grants.
I have one more political question I want to sneak in before Kojo cuts me off. Statewide vote on sports betting with the idea that money would go to schools, as always. That's what everyone says. Where are you on the statewide ballot measure to allow sports betting? Yes or no?
Yes. You know, I don't love it, but at this point, I think the horse has left the barn, so to speak.
Here is Chris in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Chris, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Kojo. Great show. And Hans, thanks for your work. I just got a question about all the recycling. And I live in Chevy Chase. We try and recycle everything. You hear all these stories about how recycling ends up in a landfill. I was wondering, does the county audit the subcontractor you guys use and make sure that the recycling doesn't get shipped to China, thrown in a landfill, et cetera?
Great question. You know, with the changing in the market, a lot of communities are finding that their recycling is not that valuable and they've stopped being able to sell it. But as far as I know, the county has managed to remain on track. One of the reasons is that residents separate their recycling. So your paper goes in one container and your mixed products go in another. That makes the products themselves much more valuable in the market. And we have continued to be able to sell our materials to companies that are recycling. So we've received several briefings. My understanding is right now things are good. You can have high confidence when you put, as long as that product is recyclable, when you put it in there, it will actually fulfill its intended, what you're intending. We are trying to address some of the issues about confusion with products. There are a lot of products now that are actually not recyclable, that are saying that they are recyclable, and we need to really make some changes so that products like expanded polystyrene, that's the hard plastic polystyrene, gets out of the waste stream because it can't be recycled. So there's more we have to do, but right now things are actually on track.
Thank you very much for your call. You and your colleague, Councilmember Will Jawando, plan to introduce a bill to remove school resource officers from schools. Tell us about that plan.
Thank you. This is a big one. I am very concerned about the school-to-prison pipeline, about using a criminal legal response for school discipline and school behavior, for team behavior. And so I am proposing with Councilmember Jawando that we roll back the student resource officer, the police officer function, and replace that position with counselors and other kinds of trusted adult figures who can really help the kids, you know, work through issues and, you know, be more constructive. I think the idea of using a police-based response in schools, it should be the absolute last resort, and I think we need to make a change.
You're leading an effort to allow solar arrays on farmland in Montgomery County. What exactly are you proposing, and what are the benefits for the county?
Thank you. Well, I got to say, I'm excited about our ability to clean up the grid, to have 100% clean energy every time we plug in our phone, turn on a light switch, plug in our car, to be powered from solar and wind. But the only way that's going to happen is if we actually allow solar to be built on the ground. Rooftops and parking lots is not enough. We have to allow property owners to build it on the ground. And I am, right now it's prohibited in 1/3 of Montgomery County, all the land that's zoned agricultural reserve. And so I have been proposing for the last year with several of my colleagues that we should allow very limited installations of solar arrays that continue to have agricultural use underneath the arrays and can support our plan, would support about 50,000 houses worth of electricity, clean, renewable electricity into the grid. And it's part of a bigger vision here of transitioning our electricity grid to 100% clean, renewable. It has been controversial. County executive is opposed. Many voices of commodity farming, you know, it's hard to get a combine under a solar array. So there's a lot of friction there. But we're trying hard to come up with solutions that can get us a yes.
And I'm afraid that's about all the time we have. Hans Riemer is an at-large member of the Montgomery County Council. Councilmember Riemer, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thank you so much.
Today's show was produced by Sidney Grannon. Coming up Monday, what does the Day of the Dead mean in a year when so many in our Latinx community have been lost to COVID-19? A folklorist from the National Museum of the American Indian explains how the traditional honoring of ancestors will continue amid the pandemic. Plus, it's Kojo for Kids, the election edition. We're taking kids' calls on everything from the Electoral College to ballot boxes and anything else about this messy democracy that makes them wonder. That all starts at noon on Monday. Until then, have a wonderful weekend and stay safe. Any big plans, Tom Sherwood?
I'm going to check out the early voting centers around Washington this weekend.
We'll see what happens with the early voting centers. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nam.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Julie Deppenbrock, Sidney Grannon, Kurt Gardiner, Lauren Marco, Richard Cunningham, and Inez Renegade. Our managing producer is Ingelisa Schroepsdorf. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. For past shows and more content, visit kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.